is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained.
Yeah, it's a great honor to have you on the show tonight. Welcome, Deepak Chopra.
Thank you.
News for the Soul is now in its 25th year of broadcasting. Tune in live or visit the archives at newsforthesoul.com. That's newsforthesoul.com.
Next on News for the Soul, it's time for the Whole Health Initiative with Dr. Holly. With more degrees than a thermometer, Dr. Holly's PhDs include psychology, natural medicine, herbal medicine, nutrition, and Ayurveda. She's a scientist, professional speaker, and the author of over 20 books. She also sees and works with energy, and she's here to help you achieve complete optimum health. Please welcome Dr. Holly back to News for the Soul.
Hi, guys. How are you all doing today? August 24th. It is a sunny day here in Vancouver, BC. Hope you're enjoying the day. I hope you're choosing to enjoy the day. I've been away for a couple of weeks, so our producer, Nicole, has presented repeat articles or programs for you. But today we are here again live, and we're going to focus on the liver, and in particular hepatitis. So what we'll do is we'll go over the liver, what the liver does. Then we'll go over some of the big issues with the liver and then how to resolve them and how that impacts on your whole entire body. All right, so first off, what does hepatitis mean? It actually just means inflammation of the liver. It really doesn't tell you much beyond that. Hepatic means liver, and usually when a medical term ends in itis, it means inflammation. Thus, hepatitis translates to inflammation of the liver. Now, that doesn't always pan out. For instance, I was using the example pneumonia. Pneumonia just simply tells you inflammation in the lungs. It doesn't tell you what kind, bacterial, viral, or otherwise. It just means inflammation of the lungs. But usually, itis means inflammation. So let's focus on the liver and hepatitis. We'll do a short overview of the liver itself. You probably all know this stuff, but just in case there's somebody out there that doesn't. The liver is the largest internal organ of the body. Now, technically, your skin is the largest organ of the body, but your skin is external. So we can say that the liver is the largest internal organ of the body. Obviously, how big it is depends on how big the person is. However, in an adult, it's usually about the size of a football, which is pretty darn big. The liver functions both as an organ and as a gland. Now, the reason we can say that is because it does produce both proteins and hormones, so it is a gland as well. There are two major components of the liver. There's the right, what's called the right lobe, and the left lobe. The right lobe is larger, and obviously the left lobe is smaller. That's redundant. Within those two major lobes, there's eight different segments, and each segment has about a 1,000 lobules or small lobes in each segment. So there's a lot of lobes, a lot of lobules in the liver. Now, what's particularly interesting about the liver is that it holds, at any given time, it holds about 13% of the body's blood. It's doing an awful lot of interaction with the blood. Even though it's the largest organ in the body, it regenerates faster than any other organ. So despite any injury or removal of tissue through surgery, the liver only requires a very small percentage of that particular tissue to rebuild. So if it has an incredibly tiny piece of each of those eight segments, it can regenerate its entire liver within a week. That is phenomenal. Consequently, when we're dealing with a lot of different disorders, dysfunctions, diseases, we're looking at the liver. So for me, my first thing is the gut, second thing is the liver, and then, of course, we go to glutathione, which we don't get involved in. We won't miss out on glutathione, being the highest concentration of glutathione is in the liver. However, we'll get to that. Now, your liver performs over 500 functions. I'm sure you've heard that. It supports every other organ and system in the body. In fact, if the liver shut down, you could only survive 1 to 2 days. Now, the upgrade to that is the liver is incredibly resilient. So let's just go over some of those 500. We'll obviously do all of them today, but we will go over some generalities to get an idea of how incredibly important the liver is. So we metabolize our food in the small intestine. We break it down. The hydrochloric acid starts in the stomach and predominantly break down the proteins. Then we have the three different categories of enzymes, amylases, lipases, and proteases that break down the food in the intestines. And then, of course, we have the microbiota that also helps with that. But when those inside the body. So from that perspective, the liver is your first step in metabolizing your food. As we said, glutathione has to be produced in every cell of the body, but the highest concentration is in the liver. Now think about over the years, if you've been paying, listening to this program, glutathione is involved in more processes in the body than any other compound, and the highest concentration is in the liver. So now you understand maybe why that's the case. Let's go on. The kidneys are often recognized for filtering the blood, but people don't actually realize that it's usually the liver that's doing the first process. So for instance, if you're detoxing, the liver will take the toxic compound out of the blood and put it through a number of different phases, either phase 1, 2, a phase 1, 2, 3, or a phase 1, 2, 3, 4. And in most cases, the end step is attaching a glutathione. The toxin can now go back into the blood to either be eliminated through your urine, or it will go down through the gallbladder along with the bile into the intestines to be eliminated. If it goes down with the bile into the intestines, you need the glutathione to attach to fiber in order to be eliminated from the body. If you don't have sufficient fiber, good reason to eat those Granny Smith apples every morning. If you don't have sufficient fiber, your body will actually reabsorb that whole complex, the glutathione as well as the toxin. So you really want to make sure you got good fiber in your system. Okay, the liver, as you've probably heard, makes about 80% of your cholesterol. So if your diet is low in cholesterol, the liver has to work harder to make more. If it's low, the liver works less to make less, okay? Now you know, we've gone over this many times before, how important cholesterol is to the body. It's utilized for all kinds of things, including the bile that goes down through the gallbladder into the intestines to help metabolize fats. It's required for the cellular membrane. If you didn't have the cholesterol stents holding the phospholipid membrane open, the transport mechanisms wouldn't work in and out of the cell. It's required for your steroidal hormones, your testosterone, progesterone, all your estrogens. It's required for the myelination of the neurons. That's all I put in there, but it's required for a whole long list of things. If you read my book, drhollybooks.com, and take the book on the heart, it'll explain not only how the heart functions and cholesterol functions, how the cholesterol myth started, why it's maintained, and what crapola it is. Okay. What else does the liver do? Well, it breaks down your old red blood cells. You make about 1 million red blood cells a day. They last for about 90 to 120 days. And then the spleen and the liver break them down. Now, when they break down, there's a byproduct, and that's called bilirubin. The bilirubin then goes down with the bile through the gallbladder into your intestines, and that's what gives your stool the color. So if your stool is particularly dark, which often, you know, if you've eaten a lot of blueberries or spinach, it will be a darker color. But in general, it should be about a medium brown, medium to a dark brown. If it's lighter than that, it's telling us that the liver is not functioning properly, that there's a blockage in the ducts in the gallbladder, from the liver to the gallbladder to the intestines, or there's an actual problem with the liver functioning. Now, you make about 800 to 1,000 milliliters of bile daily that goes from the cholesterol in the liver down to the gallbladder into the intestine. That's an awful lot of work just doing that on its own. It also regulates the amount of blood in the body, not just the red blood cells that it breaks down, but it actually regulates the amount of blood. It metabolizes proteins, carbs, and fats and prepares them for the rest of the body to utilize. With the help of vitamin K, The liver produces different compounds that regulate your blood clotting. That's why vitamin K is so important, and you don't want to take too much D3, because the rule of thumb is if you're taking over 2,000 mcgs of D3, which you know is not a vitamin, it's actually a hormone, but if you're taking more than 2,000 mcgs of D3, you need to start taking K. Vitamin K1 is found in vegetables, K2 found in animals, and that vitamin K helps to regulate your blood clotting in the working in the liver. The liver also makes a protein called albumin. Albumin does a couple of different things. It's a great transporter for nutrients in the blood, and it also helps the body protect the body from vascular leakage into areas that the blood shouldn't go. So it helps to maintain that vascular lining membrane so that the blood stays in the veins and arteries. There's a hormone called glycagon that regulates the sugar content in the blood by storing excess sugar as glycogen and then releasing it if blood sugars are too low. Now think about this. We've talked about it many times. People often think of the pancreas as being the one that's involved in diabetes 2 in particular, diabetes 1 and 2, but diabetes 2 is far more prevalent. And people think of it having to do with the pancreas and insulin or the insulin receptors. Long before the pancreas gets involved, the liver gets involved. Remember, your food goes first through the portal blood to the liver. Second, with blood glucose metabolism, is the cortisol that's produced from the adrenals. And then we get to the insulin produced from the pancreas. All right. The liver regulates hormones, and in particular, the one I like to use is estrogen, because if you have insufficient glutathione in your liver, the liver will push, in men, obviously, it will push the excess estrogen into the prostate, thus causing prostate enlargement, both because of the particling in the prostate as well as because estrogen is a growth hormone, golly gee whiz. So we want that liver to function properly, and we want sufficient glutathione so that we don't get prostate issues. Or at least you guys, obviously, we don't. That's supposed to be a joke. The liver is responsible for 80% of the conversion from T4 to T3, your thyroid hormones. We've gone over that many times. That's often not, in fact, over 80% of the time, according to the old WHO, when the WHO used to be evidence-based. Now it's politically and financial-based since about 2008. But 80%, your thyroid produces your T4 and T3. You produce a lot more T4 than T3, but T3 is a lot more powerful. So the body does the conversion, T4 to T3, as per necessary, and 80% of that conversion happens in the liver. You want a healthy liver to have that happen. The liver actually breaks down fats and lipids, which are used by the mitochondria to make energy. So more than 90% of the body's energy is considered to be stored in the liver. The liver stores fat-soluble vitamins, soluble vitamin A, which it can store for about 4 years, D3 for 4 months for D3, B12 it can do for 4 years. Vitamins, fat-soluble E and K. Now, B12 is not fat-soluble, but it can still store it for about 4 years. And that is why oftentimes when people become vegans or vegetarians and they're not getting sufficient nutrient out of their diet, they can last for about 4 years, and then they start to see a slow degrade because they've lost the nutrients that the liver can store for them. So you have to make sure if you are vegan and vegetarian, for some people that's a whole lot healthier, not for everybody, but for some people, you got to make sure that you are in fact getting all your amino acids, your iron, your B12, etc. All right. It also, the liver, activates and converts various compounds into their active form. So the one I use as an example all the time for this one is D3. So the body's production of D3 is called cholecalciferol. The D3 found in food is ergocalciferol. I never say it right. Into the active form is then called the calciferol. If I don't look at it, I can pronounce it better than if I look at it. That's the case with most things. I've had that since I was a little kid. Look away, and then you'll be able to pronounce it. Okay. The liver also stores minerals. Now, the two most commonly studied are the copper and iron, but there are indicators that it does store other things as well. The liver, in effect, has its own immune system, and it plays a major role in fighting off germs with what's called phagocytes. So if you think of the little Pac-Man on the old video game, the Pac-Man, phagocytes kind of look like Pac-Man going along and eating and destroy both viruses and bacteria, especially those that come through your digestion. Now, theoretically, your hydrochloric acid in your stomach should have killed them, if not the enzymes and other good bacteria in your small intestine. But if they get into the portal blood and up to the liver, then the liver has its own system of phagocytes that can destroy it as well. So we have lots of backup systems in the body. The liver breaks down various amino acids, and the byproduct is ammonia, which needs to be filtered out of the blood by the kidneys. If it doesn't, then we can get very acidic in the blood and have problems. The liver makes lipoproteins and other transport compounds in addition to the albumin. The albumin is a transporter in and of itself, but we make a variety of different compounds in the liver that transport nutrients in the blood throughout the body. The liver stores anthocyanins. Now, there's over 600 different types of known types of anthocyanins. They belong to a class called bioflavonoids, which belong to a class called polyphenols, and I think the latest I read was over 18,000 different polyphenols known. Now, the anthocyanins are found in a lot of foods, but certainly one of the highest concentrations is in cherries. Now, the reason we eat lots and lots and lots of cherries, I actually have 4 cherry trees in the backyard, different cherries, but the reason you want to get lots of cherries in your system in the summertime is because the compound, the anthocyanin that's found in cherries, breaks down your uric acid so that you don't get uric acid buildup. Of course, if you get a buildup, then you get the crystalline components that are often found in the feet, and in particular the big toe, and are incredibly painful. It's like walking on glass. So if you're at all gout, so basic rule of thumb is if you have any type of arthritis, you have a higher risk potential for getting gout. So all the more reason to eat lots and lots of cherries in the summer, and the liver can store that anthocyanin so that you don't get your buildup throughout the winter. Okay, so I've had both osteorheumatoid arthritis. I had fibromyalgia at the same time, so that's polymyalgia. But I eat tons of cherries in the summer to make sure that my uric acid never gets too high because I don't want to suffer that gout. The liver also removes alcohol from the blood, which we know alcoholics often have a difficult time with liver, so we'll get into that later on in the article. And the liver actually has to metabolize all your medications. And that's why they often say, don't eat grapefruit with many different medications, because it increases the P450 set of family of enzymes, which can actually end up keeping the medication in your system longer, so you might get toxic on it. Flip side of the coin, as we've discussed many times before, you eat the grapefruit to reduce the medication. The pharmaceutical companies don't like that concept. Okay, so you have a basic understanding of how important the liver is to the body's functioning. If the liver gets infected or inflamed, or if you have NAFLD, which is non-alcoholic fatty liver disorder, and about 33% of the population have that by the time they're 30, and it even includes vegans and vegetarians. Okay, so we want to make sure that we don't have any of those issues, because the liver does all those functions. Imagine the impact it can have. So some people will have virtually no symptom at all, and then others can have a tremendous impact in terms of symptoms. There's a huge degree, depends on what, where, when, how, and obviously your individual body. So let's go back to hepatitis, inflammation of the liver. And we said there was two main lobes in the liver, 8 segments, and then each segment has over 1,000 lobules. So depending on where the inflammation is and what that particular segment is responsible for will determine the impact on the rest of the body, obviously. Okay, So we'll just go over a couple of major issues, probably that everybody's heard of, hepatitis B and hepatitis C, and then we will look at the huge issue and how to protect your liver and how to increase your glutathione, which obviously helps to protect the liver. Okay, so hep B. Now, that's one of the most common serious liver infections in the world. But again, it can be from very mild to very severe. In fact, they say about 70% of the population never know that they have had it. If they do, though, what does it cause? Well, it can cause fibrosis or scarring in the liver. And obviously, whenever you have scarring, just like in the lungs or anywhere else, you have dysfunction going on because it's having to compensate for that. If you have too much fibrosis, you can end up with cirrhosis, which cirrhosis is usually referred or thought of to being connected to alcoholics, but it can also be when the fibrosis starts linking up and causing permanent scar tissue in the liver nodules, and that could prevent blood flow. Liver is the only organ in the body that has two blood flows that go into it, arterial blood flows that go into it. Liver failure. Well, that's when you have extensive scarring, inflammation, infections that can cause liver cancer and or even liver failure. Abdominal pain, that's when the liver doesn't have the sensory signals that tell us that there is a problem. But the membrane that encases the liver can cause a dull pain when it's pressured. So very similar to the brain. The brain doesn't have pain receptors either. It has pressure receptors. So if the blood or the cerebral spinal fluid or inflammation in the brain is pressing on those pressure receptors, that's when we get a signal that something's wrong. Well, same with the liver. It doesn't have pain receptors, but the membrane encapsulating it does have pressure receptors. So if it's pressured, then we will feel the pain. Now, it can also cause a dark urine. That's due to high levels of bilirubin going into the blood and into the urine as opposed to going down through the gallbladder. So if that could be a liver issue, it could be a gallbladder issue. Fever might be due to toxins in the blood that the liver can't process, and the rest of the body, the rest of the immune system is trying to fight by creating a fever to burn it out. You could have a loss of appetite, and that's one of the most common indicator signs of a liver issue is a loss of appetite. One of the things we do for that is we drink ginger tea. It promotes the production and secretion of various enzymes in the gut, and it's also very good for the liver. Nausea and vomiting. Well, that may be due to the lack of bile that's coming down from the cholesterol in the liver or to a lack of enzymes that are needed. Weakness and fatigue could be due to all kinds of different nutrients that are needed to be processed, metabolized by the liver. So you can see just with hep B, there's an awful lot of different issues that could go on. But let's just try hep C. Approximately 58 million people worldwide have hep C. And this can, I don't know why, but I did this one quite differently than I did hep B, just to give you different types of ways of looking at things. They can cause jaundice. Well, jaundice is yellowing of the eyes and the skin due to high levels of bilirubin. Can cause weight loss or gain due to ineffective production of hormones and enzymes. Can cause unhealthy blood due to lack of compounds or transporting compounds in the blood. Digestive problems, both the production of enzymes as well as the production of bile. Thyroid issues, thyroid conversion issues, like we've talked before, from the T4 to the T3, that can lead to depression, anxiety, cognitive issues. It can cause, hep C can cause a toxic buildup, not only in the liver, but in the blood, and in particular in the brain, because the liver is not detoxing these compounds. So just think about it. If it goes into the blood and it crosses the blood-brain barrier, now we've got those toxins in the brain, particularly difficult. But they can also cause things like, say, in the mouth, where you get a taste of heavy metal taste in the mouth or a musty breath. Either way, hep C can cause depletion of vitamins and minerals and various flavonoids. Remember, we're saying there's over 18,000 different polyphenols. Flavonoids is one category. That can result in a wide variety of issues like poor digestion, hair loss, skin, dry skin, poor nails, etc. Ineffective blood glucose regulation, of course, can lead to type 2 diabetes. So let's go back to glutathione. I said I would come back to it. I usually do. You've often heard me speak of the glutathione, how it's involved in more processes and functions than any other compound in the body. And not only is it important to every cell, it actually transports a major transporter of amino acids in the cell. It's hugely important to the cell functioning. If the cell doesn't have enough, the cell will die, will go into apoptosis and die. But the highest concentration of glutathione is in the liver. So glutathione is so incredibly important to the liver, and the liver is so incredibly important to all aspects of health. What do you think is going to happen if your glutathione levels go down? Now just stop and think about what we've been talking about with glutathione with the narrative that's been going on for the last 2 years. So this part will not be in the article, because we don't want them to take down the article. But where have we found issues about glutathione in the narrative? The graphene oxide. Graphene oxide is in the PCR testing. It's in all the jabs, 1, 2, and 3. It's in the food packaging. It's been found in capsules of pharmaceutical drugs, cheap soaps, shampoos, conditioners, hair dye, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's, now they're saying it's in the chemical box. They've been saying that for a year or so now. 2 years, I guess, that I know of. I don't have proof of that. I've just read many articles that claim that. But all that graphene oxide depletes your glutathione. Glutathione highest concentration in the liver that does over 500 functions in your body. It detoxes every cell in your body, and they're depleting it with the graphene oxide. So when your glutathione levels go down, your liver goes down, holy cow, almost anything and everything can be affected just on that parameter alone. Think about it. How important is that? So the question then becomes, well, how do you get your glutathione levels up? We've talked about this many, many, many times, so this is old news for many of you, but let's go over it again. Simplest way is to use N-acetylcysteine or NAC. The challenge with that is you should never use it for more than a couple months at a time. If you use it for that long, get off of it. You don't want to keep taking it. Give yourself a break, 2 or 3 weeks, then go back on it if you think you need it. Why do we need the NAC? It's called N-acetylcysteine. Cysteine is one of the 21 amino acids. It's the most unstable of the amino acids, so they attach the N-acetyl to it to stabilize it so that your body can then utilize the cysteine, absorb it, and make glutathione. Now, what happens to the N-acetyl? Well, the acetyl we use for different neurotransmitters, acetylcholine, acetylserine, etc. So it can be used in a variety of different ways as well, so you're not losing anything. What else can you do to make glutathione? Well, you can take foods that are high in glutathione, and the three that I always use are avocado, spinach, and asparagus, very high levels of glutathione. Fortunately, yeah, you're going to break it down into hydrochloric acid in the stomach. So you lose, or the cysteine comes apart, could lose it. But you're going to get a higher level of it if you eat those foods, obviously. Other nutrients that help us make glutathione include the sulfur-based foods. We've talked about garlic, how garlic has over 350 compounds. 33 of those are sulfuric compounds. College U.S. That helps us make glutathione. The cruciferous foods, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, mustard greens. And if you want to grow mustard greens, grow the red. These are called a red or a purple. It has a massive, massive leaf, like four times the size of kale. And you just need one leaf to make a whole salad for a family. Anyways, those all have sulfuric compounds to help you make the glutathione. Foods high in vitamin C, like red bell peppers. Remember, oranges don't have vitamin C anymore. They don't have magnesium in the soil, so they can't make vitamin C, but they still have, red bell peppers tend to have the vitamin C. Selenium-rich foods like beef and chicken, cheese, Brazil nuts. Now, they'll also tell you that brown rice has selenium in it. I tell people, don't eat the brown rice, because that brown shell will actually hold on to toxins, and most of our rice is growing in toxic fields, so you don't want that brown shield holding on to those toxins. Herbs that can help you make glutathione are like milk thistle and turmeric. No, both are incredibly good for the liver. So there you have it. an idea of what the liver does, how it functions, all the incredible things that it does, as well as the highest concentrations in glutathione. And because of all the graphene oxide, never mind the spike protein, all the rest of the issues that we have to deal with graphene oxide alone, we need to keep those glutathione levels up and functioning well so that the liver can function well and support the rest of the body so that we can be healthy. There you go. You got it. All right. Let's go into questions. Now, these questions are kind of old. I think Nicole gave them to me 3 weeks ago, but I haven't been here for the last 2 weeks, so now we're going to deal with them. Sorry if your questions haven't been answered, but we keep trying. Okay, we're going to start out with Shirley in Montreal. I've been experiencing a buzzing noise in my head lately, and it sounds like an electrical current. What could cause this? Well, I'm going to make the assumption that it's tinnitus. That's the most common issue of hearing buzzing in the head. About 50 million people suffer from tinnitus. There's different types of tinnitus, and the most common cause of it is low magnesium. So just take a magnesium supplement, see if that'll work. Apart from that, you could have an infection in the brain, in the ear, that's causing the tinnitus. And if you have that, you think it might be an infection, it doesn't have to cause you pain. It can just be a low-grade infection, or it can be infection, on the nerve as opposed to the cellular structure. And what we do for that is just take some coconut oil. You may want to put a little bit of oil of oregano into it, but coconut oil has lauric acid and caprylic acid, both of which are antimicrobials. So if you just put it on the outer lobe of the ear and let the blood flow take it into wherever it needs to go, that can kill any infection. All right, so hopefully that's the issue. Apart from that, there'd be a variety of things apart from that, but that would be the most common issue. So let's start with the simple, easy stuff to begin with. Okay, we got Natalie in Washington. What can I do to improve dementia for my mom? Oh, my goodness. I was up till 2 this morning. I'm tired. I had to get up at 4. I only got 2 hours sleep, so please excuse my yawning. That's why I took a holiday, was I was burning out. Now I need a holiday from my holiday. Okay. Dementia. Okay, I'm going to give you a little short story on this one. I had a gal come in. I was asking if I could do anything for her 4-year-old, who's a little wee princess. She's just adorable. But the supervisor for the daycare said, look, you got to take her out. We can't deal with her anymore. She's disrupting everybody. She has major rages that go into 1 to 2 hours. It's not like it's for 5 or 10 minutes. It's a few hours, and it's every day of the week. Grandma had also bought a ticket back home to South America. She wasn't willing to stay and deal with this little gal any longer. So they came in, Holly, what can we do? I got them to put avocado oil onto her scalp for 20, 30 minutes every night. Now, you don't want to leave it on for longer, do it too many times in a row, because you don't want to kill the natural bacteria in the scalp. But the brain is about 70% fat. So when we have issues with the brain, whether it be, say, MS or Alzheimer's, any of the 119 different dementias, whether it be strokes, what have you, I always encourage people to rub avocado oil right into the scalp. You only need to leave it on 20, 30 minutes. For some people, they'll leave it on all night and put a shower cap on so it doesn't oxidize or get onto the pillow slip, and then wash it out. If you're going to leave it on all night, just do it every couple of nights. Again, you don't want to destroy the natural bacteria for the scalp. But that's a really simple way of getting fats into the brain. Remember, if someone calls you a fathead, say thank you very much. You want those fats in the brain, the EDAs, the ALAs, the DHAs, et cetera. And rather than having to go through the whole digestive process and into the blood and then to the liver and then to the blood and across the blood-brain barrier to get into the brain, the real shortcut is just putting it right onto the scalp. And it can get in there fairly quickly. So to give you the end of the story with this little princess, they came in 10 days later. The supervisor for the daycare center wanted to know what the heck they did to this child, because she was entirely different. Grandma canceled her could get back home and everybody was a happy camper. She got the fat that she needed into the brain. And what we did with her was the 3 days in a row and then every other day and then every 3 days. And after a few weeks, the brain got what the brain needed and calmed everything down. So now I do that for all my, I never read it. I don't know why I came up with that. But I've been using it an awful lot since then. I'm even using it with my 19-year-old father. Every other day, for about 20, 30 minutes, he puts the avocado oil on because his dementia was getting pretty bad. Asking the same question 5, 6, 7 times in a 10-minute span was pretty evident that we were having a major issue. He was actually having some other issues as well. And I said, look, I know you don't want to do this, but you really need to be doing it. And ever since he started, he's doing much better. So let's give that a try again. Very simple, very easy. And we don't have to do, a whole lot of other things to see if it is working. Now, there are other things that you can be taking as nutrients for the brain. Of course, your glutathione is incredibly important to the brain. Magnesium, vitamin E, your B vitamins. Chocolate can be a tremendous help, but it has to be the good chocolate. I will say 88% or higher. Take a couple pieces a day. Chocolate has over 1,400 compounds, including various neurotransmitters and neuropeptides, so that can be useful. A big thing is to eliminate sugars out of the diet. Sugars cause all kinds of problems with the brain. What else is this? Your brain needs B9, and a great way to get B9 is in fresh farm eggs, not the ones that you buy in the store that say they're free run, but go find a farmer that actually has them. Make sure he feeds his chickens flaxseed, because flaxseed increases the nutrient density 3 to 4 times, and eggs have choline, which the body can convert to B9, which is great for the brain. But the big thing is get rid of those sugars. Holy cow, that's a huge big thing. Okay, let's move on to Suzanne in California. My sleep schedule is all backwards after working on night shifts for several years. What can I do to switch it back? Well, sleep is a programmable behavior in the body. So if you start a schedule that you stick very rigid to over the next several months, where you go to bed, whether you sleep or not, and get up, whether you're tired or not, at the same time every day. So for instance, getting up at 6 and going to bed at 10 at night. Don't nap during the day. A quick thing to do is have a shower, a cool shower, because that eliminates the positive ions and balances out the negative ions, which can help you go to sleep. You want to avoid alcohol or caffeine after dinner. You might want to drink things like chamomile tea or St. John's wort. They're very good for calming the system down. You want to avoid your computer, your cell phones, your laptops, all that kind of thing. You don't want to be watching TV or reading in bed. That can really disrupt circadian rhythms and the natural program the body has that when you lay down, you're going to go to sleep. You might want to try meditation in the evening. Exercise. Do some exercise so that the body is tired. Nutrients like GABA or melatonin can help you to go into a deeper sleep faster. With both of them, you want to get the melatonin that is time release. Melatonin doesn't help you get to sleep. It helps you to go into a deeper sleep for longer periods of time. So you want the time release. With GABA, you might have to take it. People are really, really different. I always tell people to be their own best scientist. It may work for you taking it right at bedtime, 20 minutes before, or even, you know, after dinner, depending on how your system metabolizes it. If GABA makes you feel groggy in the morning, take it earlier in the evening. So anything else? Black out any screens. If you have alarm clocks or anything that has LED readouts, and get my cell phone out of your bedroom. That's huge. Leave it in the kitchen. Don't go to bed with a cell phone. That is so detrimental on so many levels. I've resolved so many issues, not by having to give nutrients or whatever, but just get the cell phone out of your bedroom, for crying out loud. Even turned off, it will be sending out EMFs that are very detrimental. So that gives you a whole bunch of things that you can. All right, let's try. Debbie in New York. I've been feeling extra anxiety lately. I would normally go to a doctor for medication to calm me down. I thought I would check in with Dr. Holly first this time to see what she would suggest. Not going for medication, that's for sure. Okay, so what can cause anxiety? It can be an imbalance in the microbiota in your gut. So are you eating really good pre and probiotics? It could be the world's issues. You know, you're up at night and your mind just keeps going and going and going, going over all the issues that we have around us, nationally, internationally, locally, what have you, with 5G, with the jab, with going down the rabbit hole. There's so many different things, from child trafficking to the adrenochrome. Had something else that just went through my mind. I can't think what it was. That was fast. But all these different issues could keep you awake at night. If that's the case, then try meditation. Clear them all out of your mind. For some people, it works having a journal and just writing down things that they need to attend to or look at or resolve. Once it's written down, they can let it go. So those are a couple different behavioral issues you can do. With anxiety, again, meditation, Bach flower remedies are fantastic. Again, your pre and probiotics. You might want to see if you have any heavy metal toxicity. Several metal toxicities can cause anxiety. Nutrient deficiencies. There's a wide variety of nutrient deficiencies. Omega-3s, your good healthy fatty acids, your iron, magnesium, selenium, zinc, B6, B9, B3, and of course, glutathione. Glutathione is a, in that case, it would work as both detoxification and as an antioxidant. So all those different things could be causing sleep issues, and any combination thereof. It's rarely ever just one issue. But those are a wide variety of things that you can look at that can help resolve it, not just manage it. And don't forget, with your sleep medication, with your antidepressant, anti-anxiety meds, they're not healthy. Number one, 18% of medication has been shown to actually be effective. And that is taking into consideration 32 to 38% is the placebo effect. There might be some crossover there. Holy cow. Second to which, your anti-anxiety drugs are basically antipsychotic drugs. You don't want to be taking those. And all your antidepressants are based on the hypothesis that it's low serotonin, which has been shown over and over again. That low serotonin, number one, 98% of your serotonin is made in the gut, not in the brain. And it's too big to cross the blood-brain barrier. So what are you really affecting when you're taking that antidepressant, which is based on a hypothesis that has never been proven? Holy cow. So, yeah, box flower remedies, pre and probiotics, having a healthy gut, and making sure you don't have any nutrient deficiencies. Again, omega-3s, iron, magnesium. Take magnesium last thing before you go to bed. Selenium, zinc, B6, B9, D3 are all fantastic to help the brain calm down. And if you want herbs, passiflora, St. John's wort, chamomile, even herbs that affect your adrenals to regulate your adrenals properly so you're not spiking with adrenals. So things like Eleutherococcus, American ginseng, rhodiola, those could all be good for you as well. Okay, there's a ton more, but those are the most commonly researched and utilized ones. Okay, so I hope that helps you somewhat. Let's now go to the garden. Okay, now I don't really have an article per se, so I didn't send anything to Nicole at this point about gardening for today. I just want to run some thoughts past you. Number one. I've been pushing gardening for a long time. I was first initially pushing it because you want nutrient-dense food, not toxic-dense food. You don't want pasteurized. You don't want GMO. You don't want microwaved food. You want whole, good, rich foods, rich in nutrients. The problem in today's world is we're not getting that. So grow your own is the next obvious option. And I've been teaching gardening inside and outside summer and winter because there's an awful lot you can grow in the wintertime inside. Everything from your sprouts and your greens, microgreens, to a variety of different herbs, even cherry tomatoes on your windowsill. So there's an awful lot you can do that way. The challenge now that we've had is what is in the chemtrails. Whether you believe them or not, there's an awful lot of crap, this is a broad spectrum word, in our atmosphere that can be very damaging to whatever you're growing outside. So we want to be very careful. Now, there are a number of sites that are actually providing different solutions to protect your produce from the chemtrails. Well, in addition to that, we also have DARPA. That's the military component, research component, if you want, in the U.S. And doing. Now, I've heard various different interviews with people saying that this is happening, but we now have an article that's a very good article that you might want to read. It's on global research. Just pull up globalresearch.ca and then DARPA insects, and you'll get the article. It's called DARPA Insects Mad Science U.S. Nowhere to Hide. So just pull up global research and DARPA and insects. And it goes over what DARPA is actually doing. So this goes beyond the chemtrail. This goes into creating insects that are now damaging the DNA of our food. Holy cow. So let me give you an aside. We've known now for several years, a good 6-8 years, that many of the honeybee producers, commercialized honeybee, what they are now doing is feeding honeybees, when they start a new hive, they feed them high fructose corn syrup. If it's a particularly cold winter, they feed them high fructose corn syrup. The gal I get mine from, which I have a phenomenal honey, she feeds them honey, their own honey, which is incredibly nutrient dense. And bee pollen, of course, is 10 times more nutrient-dense than the honey. But if she's starting a new hive, and she has over 200 hives, then she feeds them honey, not high fructose corn, fructose. And in the wintertime, again, honey, not high fructose corn syrup. So now what these commercialized bee growers are doing is they're feeding them the high fructose corn syrup 24/7, like on a daily basis. Because they produce a whole lot more honey. Good reason to give that. Except that what is done is it's changing the DNA of the honeybees and consequently having a huge impact on the nutrient profile of our honey. Well, if just changing it from honey to high fructose corn syrup can have that much of an impact, imagine the impact it's going to have if you're changing the DNA of bees and insects. Holy cow. They're creating insects that can damage our food, that can alter the DNA of our food. Like, how? That's massive. Like, what else do we have to do to protect our food, for crying out loud? It's going off the shelf anyways. The price is going up higher and higher, but by golly, we do need to eat. So what is the next option? Well, I've been talking to you for some time now, intermittently, about growing a garage garden. Now, obviously, those that live in condos, apartments, whatever, don't have a garage to grow a garden in. But if you can grow a garden in a garage, you can grow it anywhere in your household, a bedroom, a bathroom, an office, a spare room. And what I've been trying to teach people is for a small family of four, you can actually feed them on a 4x4 foot garden. Now, do you use a regular garden? No, you don't. One person say, oh, I've done gardening and I've done research and you can't support a family. Well, actually, yeah, you can if you know how to do it properly. And what you do is you use a lot of plants that grow up. So you don't use the ground. You're using your height. And, of course, whenever you go up, you've got a lot more space to use. So indeterminate tomatoes. We've talked about the determinate are the bush-type tomatoes. Instead of using bush-type tomatoes, use indeterminate tomatoes. Rather than using bush beans, you use the pole beans. You can grow zucchini up ladders. You can grow cucumbers up ladders. There's all kinds of your sweet peas grow up ladders. There's a ton of food that you can use growing up. So if you have this bed that's 4x4, you can actually produce an awful lot of food in it. And if it's growing in your house, you don't have the susceptibility to the chemtrails and or these mad insects, mad science insects that can distort the food and distort the DNA of the food, distort the nutrient profile of the food. So more so than ever before, I'm pushing, learn how to grow your own food. Now, yes, if you're growing it in a garden, all the more in a 4x4, all the more reason to pay attention to companion growing. What grows next to one another and what doesn't? In sequential gardening, and the one I always use is there's a lot of things you can't grow in the same area that you grew cabbage. Cabbage leaves a byproduct that other plants don't like. So if you know how to do, if you just do a little bit of research, the depth of the root, the pH of the soil, companion growing, and sequential growing, you can grow a huge amount of food and herbs. I have trays in my garage now that are growing potatoes. I have others that are establishing the crowns for the asparagus. Asparagus needs 2 or 3 years to grow their initial crowns. So I'm doing that right now. I got several bins that are growing all the herbs. We know herbs are more nutrient-dense than food, so your oregano and your basil and your cilantro, sage, thyme, rosemary, I just have a lot. And then I've got one that's basically dedicated if you want to salad. So it's got all the different types of lettuces, arugula, kale, Swiss chard, cucumbers, tomatoes, peppers, celery. And then the other one is more dedicated to vegetables, other types of vegetables. So I have my zucchinis, beets, carrots, cauliflower, bok choy, zucchini, squash. And what I do, if you look it up, there's a 4x4 way of doing this. You take a 4-foot by 4-foot, put your string across, which I did, so that I got all 16 squares of 1x1 foot squares that you can grow different fruits and vegetables in. Turn the grow lights on in the morning. You don't have a grow off in the sense of a marijuana plantation. You just have your garden grow off to grow your own fruits and vegetables. And that's going to, you need ventilation and you need grow light. So if you're concerned about your food, like I am very concerned about food sources, I want to make sure my food is good and healthy. I can grow it not only outside in the summertime, but I can grow it all winter long in the wintertime. If Nicole was able to actually produce pictures, and I think she can only produce the written word, I would send you pictures. I've already got it started. I'm using it as a model so other people can see all the different options that they've got. But my garage is full of food right now. So please keep that in mind, incredibly important for your health and well-being, both physically and mentally, emotionally. And apart from all that, don't forget, we don't want to get emotionally caught up in all the horror and the crap and the rabbit hole and what have you that we have going on today. We want to use that energy, our emotional energy, our meditative energy, creative imaginations, whatever, put that towards what you want the world to be. What do we want to create? What do we want to see down the road? And let's make sure all that incredibly powerful energy goes into creating the world we want to be active in. Okay? So on that note, I hope you got something out of today's session. I wish you the very best of the week. Eat well, think well, be well, and we'll see you next week. This is Dr. Holly with choicesunlimited.ca or drhollybooks.com. Either way, hope it is the information there. So, I forgot, there's a huge big thing. We have now finished the, actually don't know if they'll ever be finished, but it is now, we're going to get the questionnaire posted on my site, choicesunlimited.ca. So if you've had any symptoms, if you know of anybody that has any symptoms from the jab, we want to get your data, get input. If there's any nurses and doctors out there that are willing to volunteer some time to help get this going so we can create this huge database that we're going out to the people and saying, look, you don't have to worry about going to your doctor and having him not put into theirs. We have this whole beautiful questionnaire that's going out now. And it not only is a questionnaire, but there's many, many things on the symptoms that you can resolve yourself in your kitchen. So we put all those kinds of things in there as well. Please be aware, choicesunlimited.ca is not up right now, but it is on peoplesofthesalmon.org at this point, and it's going to go up onto my site as well, choicesunlimited.ca. So hopefully you'll take advantage of that. And again, all the best. We'll talk about more next time. You have a great week. Talk with you next week. Take good care. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.